He told us Dylan should spill it, tell the complete truth. Before he hung up, he reassured us. Boys do dumb stuff. He's a good kid. He'll be okay. We waited for what felt like an eternity. Mrs. Harris wept. Then a deputy followed the boys through the substation office door. I practically threw up when I saw Dylan paraded past me in handcuffs. We waited hours to learn whether our children would be sent to a detention facility or allowed to return home. Finally, the officer who arrested them recommended they be considered for a diversion program, an alternative to jail for first-time juvenile offenders accused of minor crimes. The program would provide supervised counseling and community service and allow the boys to avoid criminal charges and placement in a detention facility. The boys were released into our care. Our drive home was silent as all three of us contended with our various emotions. Fury, humiliation, fear, and bewilderment. We arrived emotionally and physically exhausted around 4 o'clock in the morning. Tom and I needed to discuss how we wanted to respond. There would be consequences, we told Dylan, but we would talk about them after we got some rest. Exhausted as I was, the sun was up before I was able to close my eyes and sleep. Tom woke before I did. When Dylan got up, they took a long walk. Afterward, Tom told me Dylan had been very, very angry at the situation, the cops, his school, the unfairness of life. He was so angry that he didn't seem to accept or acknowledge the wrongness of what he had done. I was still mad myself and didn't want to talk to Dylan until I could be calm. Later in the day, the two of us sat together on the stairs. The master bedroom was on the ground floor, and Dylan's room was upstairs, so we often sat on the stairs between them to talk. I recounted our conversation verbatim in my journal that night, and have relived it in my mind countless times since his death. I began, "Dylan, help me understand this. How could you do something so morally wrong?" He opened his mouth to answer, and I cut him off. I said, wait a minute. First, tell me what happened. Tell me everything right from the beginning. He told me the story of his bizarre evening. After Zach left the church, he and Eric decided to go light some fireworks, so they drove to a parking area not far from our house where recreational cyclists stowed their cars while they biked the scenic canyon road. There, they saw an empty commercial van parked in the darkness. They saw electronic equipment inside. The van was locked. They banged on the window and tried to open it. Dylan rationalized this by noting the van was deserted. When the window did not open, they broke it with a rock. I asked Dylan if breaking the window was Eric's idea. He said no, it was both of us. We thought of it together. They took the equipment and drove to a secluded spot close by. Minutes later, a deputy drove by and saw the damaged van. He found the two boys in Eric's car, with the equipment, a short distance down the road. As soon as the officer approached the car, Dylan confessed. When I'd heard the whole story, I asked my question again. You committed a crime against a person. How could you do something so morally wrong? His answer shocked me. He said, it was not against a person, it was against a company. That's why people have insurance. My jaw dropped. I cried out, Dill! Stealing is a crime against a person. Companies are made up of people. I tried to appeal to his sense of reason. If one of our renters decided to steal a light fixture from one of our apartments, would it be a crime against a rental company or against us? Dylan relented. Okay, I get the point. But I didn't stop. I explained that the owner of the van would have to pay a deductible to the insurance company. There's no such thing as a victimless crime, Dylan. I'd heard a story about a programmer who figured out a way to siphon tiny, nearly untraceable amounts of money from calculations that left an odd penny. Before long, you'll know enough to do something similar, I told him. Do you think that's ethical? He said he knew it was not, and assured me he'd never do anything of the kind. What he'd done was wrong, and I wanted him to know it. Appealing to his empathy, I asked him how he'd feel if someone stole from him. Dylan, if you follow no other rules in your life, at least follow the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal. I paused to consider which of the other commandments might have relevance, and then decided to stop haranguing him. Those are the rules to live by. He said, I know that. We sat in silence for a little while. Then I said, Dill, you're scaring me. How can I be sure you'll never do such a thing again? He said he didn't know, and seemed frightened to learn he could do something so bad on an impulse. He was obviously miserable. I felt no anger at that point, only compassion. Before we stood, I told him he had broken our trust. We would be watching him more closely, and his activities would be restricted. He complained it wasn't fair for us to punish him on top of the diversion program. Weren't the legal consequences enough? But his actions had left us no choice. I also said I thought he should see a professional counselor. He said he absolutely did not want to do that. When I told him we would seek help if it was in his best interest, he said definitively, I do not need counseling. I'll show you I don't. I was grateful Dylan could get on with his life without going to jail. Years after his death, though, I visited a secure treatment program for juvenile offenders, the type of place Dylan would likely have been sent to, and learned that what I had feared so much would almost certainly have been better for Dylan than returning to school, especially if the culture at Columbine High School was as toxic for him as we believe it was. The administrator told me, we're into saving kids, not punishing them. He described the supports that would have been available to Dylan, such as professionals who specialized in dealing with mood disorders and PTSD, common in kids who have been bullied. The multidisciplinary team would almost certainly have diagnosed his depression, as well as any other brain health disorders he might have been living with. The staff worked closely with the offender's parents. There was even a computer training facility there. We never know what lessons are in store for us, especially when our prayers are answered and events seem to turn out the way we want. At the time, we were grateful he'd qualified for diversion. But I can't help wondering if sending Dylan to a juvenile detention facility would have saved his life and the lives of everyone he took with him. It took 2 months for the diversion program to begin. In the meantime, Tom and I worked together to tighten the reins at home. We created a curfew schedule, limited Dylan's social activities, took away his computer keyboard, and restricted his driving privileges. We searched his room regularly and told him he could not spend any free time with Eric. He was expected to spend time with us and to be cooperative when he did. Work and his participation in plays at the school were constructive influences, and he would continue to be able to do those things. Dylan was relieved when the rules were spelled out for him and accepted our conditions willingly, but it was still a difficult time. He seemed withdrawn and was quick to anger when we made any demands on him. His relationship with the outside world didn't seem to be much better. Roughly a week after the theft, Dylan got a job at a grocery store. He disliked the job and hated wearing a flowered shirt as part of his uniform. His attitude was terrible, and his time there ended quickly. Next, he got a speeding ticket. Not long after, he ran a red light on his way home from renting a video and got a ticket from the same officer who'd questioned him on the night of his arrest. After the ticket, Tom and I warned him again that he needed to get his act together. Any more mistakes and the consequences for his future could be positively disastrous. Felons can't vote or serve on a jury. He'd be disenfranchised. And who would want to hire him? A month or so after the arrest, I called the Harrises to touch base. We all wanted what was best for our children, and I thought the two families should be in contact to coordinate the consequences we had meted out. Mrs. Harris and I talked about the advantages and disadvantages of keeping the two boys apart. She told me about Eric's angry outbursts and said they planned to find professional help for him immediately. I told her we were trying to determine whether Dylan needed to see a therapist or not. I felt strongly the boys should be separated, but Mrs. Harris did not want to remove the central friendship in her son's life at a time of crisis. I understood, but felt Dylan needed some distance. We agreed to keep them apart for a while at least. There were good times as well as bad. One night, Byron called after capriciously quitting another job. I was so discouraged with both of my sons, I did not know what to do. After Tom had gone to bed, Dylan sought me out. He listened carefully and quietly to my worries about Byron and made a few suggestions while supporting the way I'd handled the call. When I was done venting, he did his best to cheer me up. That night, I felt grateful he had not been sent to jail. During that interim period, he and a friend started a fantasy baseball league. The activity seemed wholesome, and I liked the boy he started it with. Eric did not participate. Dylan also did the sound for a production of The Music Man, which we attended at the end of February. There's nothing like a school play to make parents feel proud, and we certainly felt proud of Dylan that night. Still, we were relieved when the diversion program finally started in March. During the intake process, Dylan was asked to select problems pertaining to him from a long list. Eric checked many of these, including anger, suicidal thoughts, and homicidal thoughts, but Dylan marked only two, finances and jobs. The intake included an extensive assessment of our family. I stated that Dylan sometimes seemed angry or sullen, and his behaviors were at times disrespectful and intolerant of others. That certainly was my feeling about him that year, especially after the arrest. He never raised his voice, swore in our presence, or talked back, but I could hear disrespect in his voice sometimes when he talked about others. It was the worst thing in my experience that could be said about Dylan. Later, these comments would be seen as incontrovertible evidence that we ignored warning signs and set the stage for violence by tolerating belligerence. At the time, though, I was simply eager for the counselors to know the worst about him so the experts handling his case would be able to help him if he needed it. When the counselors questioned Dylan, he admitted to using marijuana a couple of times. This surprised us, so Tom followed up with questions when we got home. Dylan didn't want to say where he'd gotten the drugs, but eventually confessed that the pot had belonged to his brother. Tom confronted Byron and warned him that if he brought illegal drugs onto our property again, he'd turn Byron over to the police himself. Juvenile records are usually sealed, but after the tragedy, Dylan's diversion reports were released. They stated that Tom and I had kicked our older son out of the house for using drugs. That brought me up short. The decision for him to leave home had been Byron's, made in consultation with a family counselor, and the move itself had been completely amicable. Plus, Byron was still very much in our lives after he moved out. We saw him for dinner at least once or twice a week. In the diversion interview, Dylan said he loved his brother, but that marijuana use was a waste of time and money. He claimed to have used alcohol a couple of times, although his journals would reveal he was self-medicating heavily. After he died, I learned that his nickname, on the internet and among some of his friends, was Vodka, the capitalized D and K, a play on his initials. Dylan was upset to discover that Tom had confronted Byron about the pot, and Tom explained he'd do anything to keep his boys safe. After the tragedy, though, Tom blamed himself for Dylan's secret life and worried he'd unwittingly damaged their relationship by violating Dylan's trust. Had Dylan held back from telling us he was scared of Eric because he knew his father would talk to the Harrises? And of course Tom would have, if he'd had any inkling of the lethal dynamic between the two boys. Years after the tragedy, I picked up a parenting magazine in a waiting room featuring an ethical parenting quiz. I got all 10 questions right, except for, would you read your child's private journal? The correct answer, according to the parenting magazine, was no. I know it would have been my answer, too, when Dylan was alive, but it would not be my answer now. When we search our children's rooms or read their journals, we risk that they will feel betrayed. However, they may be hiding problems they cannot manage by themselves. When Dylan was asked by the counselor to talk about his family relationship, he said it was better than most kids. He said Tom and I were supportive, loving, dependable, and trustworthy. In response to the question, "What impact has this arrest had on your family?" Dylan answered, "A bad one. My parents were devastated as well as I." And to the question, "What have been the most traumatic experiences in your life?" Dylan responded, "The night I committed this crime." After interviewing Dylan and our family, the writer of the treatment status report concluded, "Based on history, it does not appear treatment is indicated." Despite this, when we finally met Dylan's diversion counselor in March of 1998, it was the first thing I asked. Did she think Dylan needed therapy? When Dylan joined us, she asked him if he thought he needed a therapist, and he said no. I was a little disappointed she didn't give us more guidance. I already knew what Dylan thought. But Dylan kept assuring us he'd simply made a stupid mistake. "I'll prove to you I do not need to see anyone." We agreed to monitor the situation and to change course if necessary. Diversion took up a lot of his time that year. Dylan was provided with counseling, anger management training, and an ethics class. He was required to participate in community service activities, as well as making restitution payments to his victim, and he was tested for drug use on a regular basis. We felt the gravity of the punishment would help Dylan to understand the seriousness of his offense. Unfortunately, Dylan's and Eric's diversion appointments were often scheduled together, and they saw each other at school. Though the boys did not talk about the arrest, their friends knew they were in serious trouble because their activities were so restricted. When Judy Brown heard Eric and Dylan were in trouble with the law, she assumed it was for the threats Eric had made against her son Brooks. Eric had a website filled with hate speech and violent imagery. He made specific threats against Brooks, going so far as to include the Browns' telephone number and home address. I did not learn about Eric's website until the afternoon of the attack on Columbine High School. But Dylan had known about it, and the day before he and Eric were scheduled for their diversion intake interviews, he told Brooks. In the hallway at school, he'd slipped Brooks a piece of paper with the web address on it, warning him not to tell Eric how he'd found out. This, to me, is striking. Another one of Dylan's attempts to extricate himself from the relationship with Eric, or at least to call attention to the severity of Eric's disturbance. Everyone knew Brooks was close to his parents, particularly to his mother. Dylan had to assume Brooks would tell Judy about the site immediately. That is precisely what happened, and the Browns did go to the police. An investigator drew up an affidavit to search the Harris home, which was never shown to a judge. After Columbine, that paperwork disappeared. Not knowing about Eric's website is a huge regret, and it emphasizes how important it is for parents to share information with one another, though the conversation might be uncomfortable. It's understandable Judy didn't come to me about the website. When the two boys were arrested, she believed the police had finally taken action. She had no idea Eric and Dylan had been arrested for a theft that had nothing to do with Eric's threatening behavior, just as I had no idea Eric had threatened Brooks or anyone at all until the afternoon of the tragedy, when Judy Brown was standing in my driveway and 15 people were lying dead in the school, countless others injured and traumatized. The limitations we placed on Dylan after his arrest felt restrictive to him, and he was short-tempered with us. Since there had been no indication on the diversion screening of any psychological problems, we tolerated his irritability and tried to keep him engaged in family activities as much as we could. As always with Dylan, there were enough good times to keep me hopeful. For all the unpleasantness and disagreements in those months, There were many times when we got along and enjoyed each other's company. When Dylan asked me what I wanted for my birthday at the end of March, I said I'd like some time alone with him. He took me out for breakfast. I tried to get him to talk about himself, but Dylan answered my questions as briefly as possible, then asked me about my job and my life. He was so adept at listening that I did not see how skillfully he turned the focus of the conversation away from himself. Before our pancakes were cold, I was babbling about my artwork, my job, and my dreams for the future, without recognizing how deftly he had shielded his inner life. By the close of Dylan's junior year, things seemed to be getting back to normal. Dylan spent afternoons and evenings at rehearsal for a school production of Arsenic and Old Lace. We began to talk about his life after graduation. He felt burned out and didn't want to go to college, but we encouraged him to think about it, and a few days later, he agreed to come with us to the high school to look at college resources. Dylan was smart, but he hadn't been truly motivated by what he was studying since he'd left the gifted program. I felt sure he'd flourish at college, with more freedom to discover and pursue his passions. On April 20th, exactly 1 year before his death, he and Tom went to their first baseball game of the season. The following week, Tom and I went to see Arsenic and Old Lace. Dylan's contribution to the performance was flawless. Though I cannot say he appeared completely happy, he seemed more balanced, as if he was trying to get past the mistakes he had made. That spring, we had the worst argument we ever had during his lifetime. It happened on Mother's Day, the last Mother's Day we had together, and it still hurts me to remember it. I can't remember exactly what set me off. I was heartsick about the disastrous year I'd had with both my kids, angry about Dylan's continuing negativity and bad attitude, and quietly hurt he had forgotten Mother's Day. When I confronted him about his attitude, I had the feeling he was responding not to me, but to some inner joke. It seemed disrespectful. Fed up, I got in his face. I shoved him against the fridge, pinning him there with my hand. Then I waved my finger and gave him a real mom lecture. I didn't yell, but there was authority in my voice as I told him he had to stop being so crabby and selfish. The world doesn't revolve around you, Dylan. It's time for you to think about the other people in this family. You need to start carrying your weight. Then I reminded him he had forgotten Mother's Day. I dug my hand hard into his shoulder while I lectured. Until the day I die, I will never stop wishing that I had pulled him toward me instead of pushing him away. Finally, in a soft voice that carried warning power, he said, "Stop pushing me, Mom. I'm getting angry, and I don't know how well I can control it." That was all it took. This wasn't my parenting style. Appalled that the conflict had progressed this far, I backed off. It was the worst confrontation we'd ever had in 17 years. Later, we sat together at the kitchen table. We both felt awful. I apologized for losing my temper. Dylan apologized for forgetting Mother's Day and volunteered to help me prepare dinner. That afternoon, he went out to buy me a card and an African violet planted in a tiny watering can. It was the perfect gift. I love miniatures, and we'd collected some together when he was little. We hugged. I thought it was okay, although I noted he'd only signed his name to the card instead of saying, "Love, Dylan." Of course, I wished we hadn't fought, particularly on Mother's Day, but I felt justified. Aren't you supposed to confront your kids when you feel like they're straying off the straight and narrow? I feel differently about that fight now. I know that hugging my son and telling him I loved him wouldn't have stopped him from hurting himself and others. Still, I wish I had taken his hand. Sit down with me. Talk to me. Tell me what's going on. Instead of telling him everything he was doing wrong or what he had to be grateful for, I wish I'd listened and validated his pain. If I had to do it over again, I'd tell him, "You've changed, and it's scaring me. But I wasn't scared. I should have been, but I was not. I can now see there was a great deal to be concerned about in Dylan's junior year. In the background, there was the worry of Tom's illness, financial uncertainty, and friction between Tom, Byron, and me. All these factors increased the risk of depression in the vulnerable. Dylan's arrest and the bullying he was experiencing at school are both social factors associated with a higher risk of depression and suicidality. His increased irritability and an uncharacteristic lack of motivation were signs of depression, though these seemed well within the parameters of what a parent could expect from a teenage boy. He carefully hid his alcohol use, another risk factor, from us. Every time we felt truly concerned about him, he'd go out of his way to reassure us that everything was okay. So how does a concerned parent parse out the difference between garden-variety adolescent behavior? He's so lazy. He's got such a crappy attitude. She's such a drama queen. From real indicators of depression or other types of brain illness. The crucial question raised by a story like mine is how to tell when actions or words indicate something worrisome. There is no fail-safe answer. In fact, these are some of the most troubling unresolved issues in the field of behavioral medicine. But Dr. Christine Moutier of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention teaches medical students and physicians to pay attention to changes in sleep patterns, expressions of anxiety, shifts in mood or usual patterns of behavior, or in a teen's personality. Taken individually, these may indicate nothing more than a stressful week, but a constellation of changes may signal a more serious problem. Junior year, Dylan went from being the kid I didn't have to worry about to the kid I was worried about all the time. After 16 years of no trouble at all, suddenly he was in conflict with the authorities at his school, with us, with other kids, and ultimately with the law. Dr. Mary Ellen O'Toole, a former FBI profiler and a forensic behavioral consultant, authored the FBI report, The School Shooter, A Threat Assessment Perspective, shortly after the tragedy. She warns against relying on a kid's self-reporting and advises parents to look at behaviors. If something seems inconsistent or inexplicable, get another pair of eyes on the problem, and don't allow yourself to be mollified. Loving our kids makes us more susceptible to ignoring disturbing behaviors or explaining them away. This is especially true when the kid in question is a good kid and when we have a good relationship. It's a fight to see these behaviors clearly and to act when we notice something, but you'll never forgive yourself if you don't. If you're worried, Dr. Moutier advises, seek expert help. If the child is okay, hearing it from a therapist will make you feel better. If there is a more serious problem, a therapist is more likely to recognize it and can help. Dylan did not want to get help. His journals show he was trying to manage his problems by himself. Given this aspect of his personality and his innate stubbornness, I'm not convinced I would have been able to force him to see a therapist. Even if I had gotten him to the office, he would have been perfectly capable of sitting there in sullen silence for an hour. I asked Dr. Langman, who specializes in adolescence, what he suggests to parents whose child won't cooperate. He told me he asks the parents to come in. Often a conversation with them is enough to determine whether further intervention, such as contacting a child's guidance counselor at school or even law enforcement, is necessary. Dylan promised he'd turn his life around, and then he did. According to Dr. O'Toole, that recovery might have been a sign in itself, one especially common among young women in abusive relationships. As soon as a parent moves to intervene, "I don't want you seeing Johnny anymore," the girl returns to actively managing their impression of her. There are, of course, no guarantees a child will be okay, even with professional help. Eric's parents did send him to a psychiatrist after the arrest, and he began taking medication. none of which stopped him from putting into motion the events of April 20, 1999. These days, when I page through one of my old diaries and read an entry like, "Dylan Crabby, when reminded to feed the cats," part of my brain howls, "How could you miss that? Didn't you know depression often presents as irritability in adolescent boys?" I did not, and I am not alone. Somewhere out there in America right now, a suburban mom is pointing with exasperation at two hungry, hopeful cats threading around the ankles of a teenage boy who has forgotten to feed them. Chances are, that boy will grow up, without a vent, to lecture his own teenager over a pair of empty cat food bowls. But for some percentage of families, this will not be the happy outcome. Some unlucky mix of a child's vulnerabilities and the circumstances that trigger them will combine to set off a much darker cascade. Chapter 14. Pathway to Violence, Dylan's Senior Year. Excerpt from a September 2007 letter from Tom Mauser, the father of Daniel Mauser, one of the boys killed on April 20, 1999, at Columbine High School. "It has always been my feeling that one of the great tragedies of Columbine is the fact that yourselves and the Harrises shared nothing of your own lessons from Columbine. That is, you failed to respond to the questions so many parents in the world have. What signs of hatred and despair did you see? What warning signs did you miss? Were you a family that ever spent much time at the dinner table together? What did your son talk about? What would you have done differently in raising Dylan? The most nagging question to me involves what your son hid from you. I've heard a number of people say that teens can be very good at hiding items, e.g. bombs and guns, and secrets from their parents. I don't disagree with that, but this was not just a case of hiding things. Your son was so angry and distressed and hateful and so troubled that he wanted to kill hundreds of his classmates. Hundreds. How in the world could you not have seen that your son was that hateful and troubled? How did you become so disconnected that you did not see this disposition of his? How could that happen? I think you could do a great service if you were to speak publicly about those lessons. Sure, it would be very difficult for you to do so. Painful, yes. Might people say you were terrible, neglectful parents? Sure. But obviously, many say that already. To me, what's most important is that the pain you might encounter by being open and speaking publicly could not possibly be worse than the pain you've already experienced in losing your son in such a tragic way, not to mention the guilt associated with doing nothing as repentance. I know that people want a window into the last days of Dylan's life, and so I have opened my journals and Dylan's to build a parallel timeline. Threat assessment professionals talk about a pathway to violence. Dr. Reed Malloy explained, "Targeted violence often begins with a personal loss or humiliation. That incident becomes a decision point where the person believes that the only way to resolve this grievance is to carry out an act of violence. The first step is researching and planning for the event. The next is preparation, the accumulation of weapons, the selection of a target. The next is the implementation of the attack." Eric was on a pathway to violence, probably as early as April of 1997, when the boys first began to make little bombs. He believed that Dylan was on that pathway too, but Dylan's journals tell a different story. He was pretty sure he was going to be dead long before Eric had the chance to execute his plan. Dylan's personal pathway was toward suicide, until January of 1999, when suddenly it was not. It wasn't that Tom and I didn't know that something was wrong with Dylan in his senior year. We simply, drastically and lethally, underestimated the depth and severity of his pain and everything he was capable of doing to make it stop. Journal entry, August 20th, 1998. Made Dylan spend a few minutes with us when we all sat in the den and ate dinner. It's so hard to connect with him. He just pushes us away. We've got to keep trying to have some kind of relationship. Journal entry August 28, 1998. Dylan came home from school on his way to work, and I fixed him a snack. He felt lousy, thinks he's getting a cold or worse. He picked out a yearbook picture before going to work. Tom got home late, and I made a nice little dinner. Dylan came home and joined us before going out. During the summer between Dylan's junior and senior years, he acted like a typical teenage boy, sometimes funny, playful, and affectionate, other times withdrawn, cranky, and self-involved. I always had the feeling, though, that he was holding something back. Dylan was still on a short leash at home. We searched his room to make sure he wasn't hiding drugs or anything stolen. He'd always been good with money, but he was short a lot that summer. Tom nagged him to get a job, but he didn't want to settle for fast food. He wanted to work with computers. He was making restitution payments to the victim of his crime, and while he picked up a little extra money by doing odd jobs for us and for our neighbors, we made up the difference when he fell behind on his car insurance. At the diversion orientation meeting, the parents had been asked not to contact the staff. "If you don't hear from us," they told us, "it's going well." Even though we found out later that he sometimes missed appointments or showed up late, we didn't hear a thing. When Dylan's original intake counselor left, a new one called to introduce himself. And that was it. Years later, I read the first counselor's case notes. She said Dylan was a nice young man, kind of goofy, and a bizarre sense of humor. He makes me laugh. I've talked to the friends Dylan spent time with that summer many times since then. I've asked point blank if they saw signs of depression or rage, but Dylan's behavior seemed as normal to them as it did to us. Some of his sillier moments were caught on film. Devin's 16th birthday party had a luau theme, and she gave me a photo of Dylan in the lurid Hawaiian shirt and straw hat she'd lent him for the occasion. Underneath, she wrote, "He hated it, I could tell, but he put it on anyway." She goes on to describe how much he ate. Nate slept over often. The two of them would stay up until nothing was on television but infomercials. They'd turn the volume down and make up dialogue to accompany the sales pitches, laughing so hard they'd give themselves stomach aches. Then the two of them would raid the kitchen. They ate Polish sausage, apple crisp, donuts, and plowed through chips and salsa by the ton. Tom used to say we should buy stock in Oreos. Despite this apparent normalcy, in the journal entry dated August 10th, Dylan writes a passionate and secret final goodbye to the girl he secretly has a crush on. One suicide note in a journal filled with them. Days before the start of Dylan's senior year, he was hired to do tech support at a computer store. He willingly accepted the store's dress code, a collared shirt and black pants, and worked 11 hours on his first day, arriving home tired and proud. Tom and I noted that Dylan's long day was likely the first of many if he chose a career in computers. As the fall approached, incoming seniors at Columbine High School were asked to submit pictures for the yearbook. A local photographer shrewdly suggested Dylan ask a friend to the session to help him loosen up, so Zach tagged along. And I loved the shots the photographer took of Dylan, looking relaxed and happy among the pink rocks in the valley not far from our home. One of those photos would later be featured on the cover of Time magazine, under the headline, "The Monsters Next Door." As Dylan began his senior year, life settled down for the whole family. Tom and I were cautiously optimistic and proud when Byron finally landed a job he loved at a car dealership. His supervisors were mature, encouraging mentors, as eager to teach him about the business as he was to learn. He moved nearby to be closer to work, so we saw him more often, and Tom and I watched with growing pleasure as our older son seemed to grow up overnight. He even adopted a kitten, and I was touched to see what a loving and nervous new dad he was. That job would prove to be a turning point in Byron's life, the place where he transitioned into manhood and became the hard-working, responsible, thriving adult he is today. Tom and I purchased a second rental property downtown and rented the studio outbuilding on our property. The additional income alleviated our money worries, though we still didn't know how we'd manage Dylan's college expenses. Most important, Tom finally found a combination of medications to give him some relief from his chronic pain. He still had a few surgeries to go through, but he could do much more than he'd been able to. I'd settled into my new job, too, and enjoyed the freedom granted by my 4-day work week. With more time to cook, I shamelessly used food as a lure to get the family together. I made beef stew and lasagna, the gloppy, layered Mexican casseroles both boys loved, Dylan's favorite pumpkin spice cake, and tapioca pudding by the vat. I put up triple batches, one to eat, one to freeze, so I could get something on the table in a hurry, and the last so I'd have something extra to send home with Byron. Sunday dinner with the whole family happened almost every week. Byron and Dylan staged epic dish-towel-flicking fights in the kitchen. Though they looked like grown men, they were really still boys. I also had time to concentrate on my art. I'd always loved the technical challenge of translating a three-dimensional world into two dimensions, and over the years I'd taken the occasional class and sporadically attended figure-drawing sessions on Saturday morning with my friends. But between raising my family, running a household, and work, months would go by sometimes without an afternoon free. Certainly, I'd never before hit a creative groove the way I did that year. I could lose myself for hours in a drawing or a painting, thinking of nothing but how to more faithfully translate the colors and shapes I saw in nature onto the paper in front of me. My journals from those days are filled with the issues preoccupying me. Chalky whites, muddy colors, tricky shadows, composition, detail, and form. After Columbine, convinced my trivial preoccupations had blinded me to Dylan's distress and plans, it would be years until I could make art again. Journal entry, November 5, 1998. Tom is having outpatient hand surgery tomorrow. November 6th. We were at the hospital till 5, then we began our slow trek home through traffic. We stopped for Chinese takeout and medication. We were glad that Dylan stayed home, so we could actually eat dinner with him. His car is broken, so he was stuck here until a friend picked him up at about 9 to go to a movie. I want so much to be closer to him, but he is absent so much of the time. This is such an important time. He really needs to be planning for his future, but he just isn't moving ahead. At least he was pleasant tonight and ate with us. November 9th. Dylan was cute and pleasant today and actually talked about wanting to go to school in Arizona to escape the weather. The previous year's problems appeared to be behind Dylan. He could be moody and irritable, but what teenager isn't? Sometimes we noted that he was tired, but the computer store job required a lot of hours, and he was taking calculus, advanced video production, English, and psychology on top of an early morning bowling class. Without any prompting from us, he kept his appointments with his diversion counselor, participated in community service at a local park, and took routine drug tests. Although drugs had never been a problem with Dylan, we were relieved to have one less thing to worry about. He started earning back the privileges he'd lost after the arrest, and when his computer store job proved to be too difficult to maintain around his school and diversion appointment schedules, he was rehired at Blackjack Pizza. On September 11, 1998, Dylan turned 17. Our gift to him was a nod to his prodigious appetite, a small black refrigerator that he could take with him to college the following year. He loved it and insisted on carrying it right up to his room, the cord dragging behind. As soon as Nate found out, he showed up with a companion gift, a supersized bucket of fried chicken, all for Dylan. That month, He volunteered to do the sound for a Halloween production of Frankenstein at school and rekindled his friendship with Brooks Brown. The two of them had drifted apart after the conflict between Eric and Brooks the previous year, but they fell back into an easy friendship while working on the play. Dylan was proud of Frankenstein. He used a wide variety of unusual audio sources to develop the eerie soundtrack. The cast and crew recorded a surprise video to thank the drama teacher. In the video, Brooke, Zach, and Dylan clown around, saying they hope she'll buy them beer or pay them to pass down their senior year production know-how to the next crop of students. Judy Brown threw the wrap party and took a picture of Dill laughing at the video along with everyone else. Dylan promised he'd finish his college applications by Christmas. We had to nudge him a few times, but he did his usual thorough job, and Tom and I helped him to keep the paperwork straight. We asked him to consider some smaller schools, but he wasn't interested. He applied to 2 schools in Colorado and 2 in Arizona, and we all celebrated when he dropped the 4 college application packets into the mail. Christmas was low-key and comfortable. As usual, Dylan led the way in finding and decorating our tree. He always wanted the biggest one we could fit on top of our car. It was an annual tradition for me to drag Tom and the boys to some festive event, a madrigal choir session, or a holiday event at the zoo. That last Christmas, it was dinner at a Moroccan restaurant, where we sat on cushions on the floor and ate without silverware, scooping the spice dishes into our mouths with pieces of bread. Dylan had asked Tom if he could borrow some money to buy Christmas gifts, and I was touched to find a hardbound writing journal from him under the tree Christmas morning. It was perfect, thoughtful without being extravagant. I had no idea I'd be pouring my sorrow onto its pages 4 months later. Tom and I bought Dylan the long black leather coat he'd asked for. Tom thought it would look ridiculous on Dylan's lanky frame, and I privately agreed. But several boys at the school wore similar black coats, and he'd already bought a black cotton duster. He thought it was funny when a teacher or some other person in a position of authority saw him and Eric in the hallway and teased, "You look like you're in the trench coat mafia." But I didn't know until after their death that there was a large, loose group of kids at the school who wore long black coats and called themselves that. A great deal was made of Dylan's affiliation with the Trenchcoat Mafia in the immediate wake of Columbine. It was one of the clues everyone hoped would elucidate what we'd missed, the key to unlock the mystery. Was the Trenchcoat Mafia a gang of death-obsessed goths, neo-Nazis, Satanists, a suicide cult? Like most such leads, the Trenchcoat Mafia connections sputtered out without revealing anything, though not before a myth had been created. In fact, the Trenchcoat Mafia was just a bunch of kids, some friends, some not, who favored a certain kind of coat to set themselves apart from the kids at Columbine High School who shopped at more conservative stores, like Polo or Abercrombie & Fitch. Dylan and Eric hadn't even thought of themselves as members of the group, although they were friends with a boy, Chris, who was. Regardless of how we thought the coat would look, it seemed harmless enough, and Dylan was thrilled when he unwrapped it on Christmas morning. Journal entry, January 11, 1999. This long, hard day is over. Tom's surgery was today. We had to get up at 4 a.m. to be there by 6. After sitting and waiting for 13 hours, I just needed to get home. Good thing I did, because Dylan hasn't exactly risen to a level of responsibility in my absence. He overslept and missed a class and was sleeping when I got home. Nothing taken care of that I needed him to do, like take care of the cats. What have I raised? January 12th. Tom is home from the hospital. Dylan has been so reclusive. We've hardly seen him, and attempts to engage him have been futile. He didn't even say hi to Tom or ask how he was. It was weird. In January, about 3 months before the tragedy, Tom had surgery to replace a portion of his left shoulder joint. I came home from the hospital in the evening to find Dylan had not done what I had asked him to do. I no longer remember what the chore was. Probably cutting up some broccoli for dinner, or picking up a quart of milk from the store. A recorded message informed me that he had missed a class. The cats had not been fed, and Dylan was asleep in his room. I was disappointed and irritated he had dropped the ball while I was looking after his father in the hospital, and I told him so. I can't count the number of times I've shared this story with other suicide loss survivors. I couldn't understand why she wasn't pulling her weight, a mother I met recently told me, the tears streaming down her face. I told her to stop being so selfish. 4 days after the argument, her daughter was dead. Sometimes a kid messing up at school or coming at you with a bad attitude about helping at home isn't a sign they need to be criticized and corrected, but a signal that they need help. Dylan often appeared tired, and I worried aloud about his course load and blackjack schedule. Tom and I were both concerned about how listless and withdrawn he was during the week of Tom's surgery, so we took him out for Chinese food as soon as Tom was up to it, a few days after the operation. The meal passed pleasantly, and we were placated. In retrospect, I can see how often Dylan expertly allayed our concerns whenever we raised them. I don't know whether he was managing himself or us, whether he was hoping whatever was wrong would get better, or that we wouldn't notice how bad it was. He'd always been the kid we could rely on to do the right thing, the kid who wanted to take care of everything himself. So when he said he was okay, we believed him. His journals indicate a major sea change had taken place in his thinking. The entry on the 20th of January reads, "I'm here, still alone, still in pain." He has not died by suicide, and he is angry. The syntactical irregularities noted by Dr. Langman come fast and furious to the point that much of the entry is almost incomprehensible. "I love her. The journey, the endless journey. Started, it has to end. We need to be happy, to exist, timely. I see her in perfection. The halcyons. Love it. Endless purity." It is possible that he was drunk. There is a sense of fantasy becoming reality for him. The scenarios, images, pieces of happiness still come. They always will. "I love her. She loves me. I know she is tired of suffering as I am. It is time. It is time." On the 23rd of January, 3 days later, he secretly attended the Tanner Gun Show with Eric and Robin, where they bought the shotguns they would use in the massacre, and met Mark Manis, the young man who would sell him a Tech-9 semi-automatic pistol. The irony is that I was never happier than I was in the winter of 1999. The weekend after Tom's surgery, Byron came over in the afternoon, and the three men of the family worked on their respective cars, car parts scattered across the garage. Tom was not able to use his arms much, but he could give advice and oversee the work, and the three of them joked and helped each other. I stayed inside where it was warm, working on a painting, while a pot of homemade chili simmered on the stove. When the guys came inside, I watched a Denver Broncos game on TV with them, just so I could bask in the pleasure of having my family together. Time was flying. Dylan would be off to college in the fall, and I didn't want to miss a single moment. After Byron headed home, Dylan and his dad drove off to rent a movie in Tom's cherished, carefully maintained classic car. On the way back, Tom let Dylan drive it for the first time, and Dylan came home puffed up with pride. It had been an absolutely perfect day, a thought I recorded in my diary before bed. "I feel so lucky and thankful," I wrote. "This day was golden." Of course, I have wondered many times about the ease of Dylan's deception. As it does for many people living with thoughts of suicide, making a plan may have made it easier for Dylan to function, and thus to mislead us into believing his life was turning around. It can be hard to differentiate between someone who is genuinely getting out of a cycle of depression and someone who feels relief because they know they're going to die. Dr. Duane Fuselier, who spent much of his career with the FBI in hostage negotiation, tells his students to pay attention when a crisis negotiation seems to be going well for the same reason. Sudden cooperation may mean the hostage taker has made a decision to die. But I still cannot reconcile the kid cracking up with me over Alec Guinness in Kind Hearts and Coronets with the boy I saw on the basement tapes, a boy who had already started making plans to slaughter innocent classmates. The deception was universal. 2 days after our chilly dinner, Tom and I received an unexpected phone call from Dylan's diversion counselor. Unless we had any objections, he was recommending early termination from the program for both Eric and Dylan. This was terrific news. Early termination from diversion is rare, awarded to only 5% of participants. Both boys had done exceptionally well, the counselor told us, and he was convinced they were on solid ground. It was 10 weeks before the massacre. People tend to find this detail particularly upsetting, but it does not surprise me. If I didn't know what was in Dylan's mind, the child I bore and raised, who sat on my lap and emptied my dishwasher, then what on earth could a stranger have known? In his book, The Anatomy of Violence, Dr. Adrian Raine cites a study in which children are left in a room and told not to peek at a toy when the experimenter leaves. Whether they do peek or not is caught on tape, as is their response, truthful or deceitful, when the experimenter returns and asks them if they did. When the "Did you peek?" interviews were shown to undergraduate students, they guessed correctly which kids were lying only 51% of the time, only a little better than sheer chance. Next, the researchers brought in customs officials who, as Dr. Raine points out, have lots of experience sniffing out people traveling with contraband. These seasoned professionals correctly guessed which kids were lying only 49% of the time, which is worse than flipping a coin. The researchers then brought in police officers to view the tapes. They guessed correctly 41% of the time, significantly worse than chance. You'd think it would be easier with the youngest children, but even 4-year-olds could convincingly fool the pros. Somewhat gleefully, Dr. Raine sums up the study results. Parents, you think you know what your kids get up to, but actually, you don't even have a clue with your own toddler. That's how bad the story is. Sorry, mate, but you really are as hapless as I at figuring out who a psychopathic liar is. It is a cold consolation to me. It does not surprise me that Dylan and Eric were able to deceive their teachers, a school counselor, Eric's psychiatrist, and the diversion specialists. But until April of 1999, I would have told you Dylan couldn't have fooled me. The week after the call from Dylan's diversion counselor, his college acceptance letters started to arrive. Dylan had been accepted to one school in Colorado, waitlisted at another, and accepted to 2 in Arizona. He seemed lukewarm about the Colorado school, but pleased to have some options in Arizona. Life is falling into place for him, I thought, as I arranged a dinner with the Harrises to celebrate the boys' termination from diversion. Though we had made efforts all year to keep the two apart, our concerns about their relationship had receded. Certainly Eric had shown us he was impulsive and emotional, but he was under the close supervision of his parents, and he'd started seeing a therapist. The boys were about to graduate from high school, their mistakes behind them, and I was pleased for the families to be able to recognize their accomplishment. Life gives few enough opportunities to celebrate, and we had a great deal to be thankful for. Some weeks earlier, I had asked Dylan about his friends' plans. He said Nate, Zach, and some of the others were off to college. Eric was hoping to join the Marines. Before our dinner with the Harrises, I asked Dylan for an update on Eric's plans. Joining the Marines had fallen through, he told me. Eric would be living at home, working, and attending community college instead. During this conversation, Dylan had a faraway look, which made me worry he was having second thoughts about his own college plans. After an initial flurry of excitement over a warmer climate, he'd withdrawn, becoming